This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good morning, and welcome to the Monday morning break with me, Marie. I'm really looking forward to speaking to Kirsten this morning about all things well-being, pupil well-being, and strategies that you can implement in the classroom.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're all really well on this Monday morning. You might be able to tell I've got a bit of a cold, but hopefully that's not going to interfere with today's show. And I'd just like to say a really warm welcome to Kirsten. So thank you for joining us today, Kirsten.
Hi, good morning. Thank you ever so much for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to our chat today.
Oh, me too. I mean, we've been arranging this for a while now. And I'm just really, really looking forward to really talking about well-being because, you know, for me, it's just one of the most important things, I think. So just to start, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners and just kind of give us a bit of your background, if that's okay?
Yes, hi. So I am based in Scotland. You can probably tell by my accent. I trained as a teacher of history and started my career in 2008. I've primarily been a classroom teacher for many, many years, but I also work as a pastoral lead. And more recently, I've become an author and I'm a writer, and I do quite a lot of work within the wellbeing space, looking at wellbeing for teachers, pupils, and what it means for us within education as a whole.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to get into this because I just think it's well-being for teachers as well is absolutely key, isn't it? Thinking about your pupils is so important, but so is teacher well-being, which is it's really difficult at the moment, isn't it? I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, it's such a multifaceted area to look at because you're dealing, you know, with individuals, but you're also dealing with organizations and structures. And it's just, it's a really, really interesting, but really, really productive space to be in as well. I think there's some wonderful things happening and, you know, time has moved on so much since certainly when I was at school as a student myself. And you know, we just have a different way of looking at it, and that well-being lens is much more the norm, I think, within education as well. And that's really promising to see.
I totally agree. Totally agree. I love that, the well-being lens. That's great. So to start with, shall we just start getting into sort of definitions of well-being, and I guess sort of what are the workable definitions?
Oh, absolutely, Marie. I'm delighted that that's the first question because it's such an important starting place. I think we've almost got a bit of fatigue when it comes to the word well-being. You know, in the last 20 years, it's changed its meaning dramatically. And where we see it in publications, we hear it in the media, it's very much used as a political kind of axe to battle with schools with. Are we doing enough? Where is people well-being? Where is their mental health? And it comes at us from so many different angles. And it's really, really important to get to that starting block and think about what does it mean in education and what should it mean in education? So we've got so many different ways of looking at well-being, you know, hedonic well-being, that kind of pleasure for right now, that chocolate bar I've just had at break time, certainly making me feel a little bit calmer now and a little bit happier. But I think what more times than not, when we're looking at well-being within education, we're actually considering the economic well-being of a young person and that subjective experience where a young person can identify that they have positives, what's going well for them, and that they're able to fill their potential. So when I did my master's thesis it was a master's in education, I looked at the definitions of well-being. And one of the most important things my findings led me down the path of was looking at where a teacher's well-being understanding comes from. And more often than not, it comes from their own life experience and what they sort of their own eudaimonic well-being and what matters to them as well. And that's not a bad thing. You know, we are people, we are humans, and we are there to have that human input as well. Within the UK, we're really fortunate that all four nations have got fantastic legislation prioritising wellbeing. But I think if you want a workable definition, I think that's what you asked for at the start, we need to view wellbeing almost like a seesaw, Mari. So we've got in the middle that kind of place where a young person can join in, they can move forward, they can progress, and they can achieve. And on the other side of that seesaw, one side, we've got the challenges that a young person might face. Now, as a classroom teacher, I can't necessarily remove them. I can't remove the learning barriers that so many young people have within schools. I can't remove grief that our young people might experience or any number of other challenges. But what I can do at the other side is I can activate the resources that our school system is so well placed to do to get that balance in the middle. So yes, we have difficulties, but we can still move forward. And that not only helps a young person in school, but also starts to sort of underpin that need to show that resilience is so important for lifelong well-being and build those toolkits for what you can do yourself to actually manage issues in the future as well.
That's so interesting. There's quite a lot in what you've just said. and it is, it's fascinating. I think so. A couple of things: that the differences between well-being, you know, like you were saying, that hedonic, and that ties in a lot, doesn't it, as well, with that's the actual science of happiness. There was a lot from Harvard, wasn't there, on the actual science behind it, and that hedonistic sort of pleasure of things, versus what you're talking about, that kind of the seesaw. I love that analogy, because you're absolutely right in terms of life events and barriers, and you know, we're never all going to be happy and you know, all the time, because like you said, we're human, and these. But I just love that analogy that on the other side of that seesaw, you've got all the resources and the support to be able to sort of counteract things that are going to happen.
And I think as well, it's so important to acknowledge that we're not looking to wave magic wellbeing wands. And, you know, it's not possible to go into this thinking that we can eradicate every challenge a young person faces. I think that's what leads to teacher burnout, frustrations, and all those difficulties. And those sort of, you know, the kind of inner eye rolling that sometimes you feel when teachers feel they're being asked to fix society, because no, that's absolutely not what I'm about. That's not the space I work in. It's very much about practical, sensible, and just really meaningful things we can do within our power.
I love that, because that's something when I was the head of Inclusion College, that's very much our outcomes. What we're aiming for is for young people to have the strategies to be able to independently manage their mental health and well-being in the future. Because, you know, as teachers, we're not always going to be there. It's not, you know, a saviour. You know, we're not waving a magic wand, like you said. Because, you know, it's about, isn't it, giving them the skills and the resources to be able to do it themselves. I love that. I think that's, you know, so with what we're aiming for as well over here. I think I just go back as well, something that you said I really thought was interesting about the fact that quite often we are judging well-being and what well-being looks like and sounds like and feels like. We're judging that on our own life events and our own feelings. I mean, that's really interesting actually, isn't it? Because we're all going to have...
Such a good study. It was so interesting. And I really, you know, I did the study actually through the pandemic. And I think for my own well-being, it was certainly a challenge. But it was really interesting to have that space and time to really speak to practitioners. And I sampled practitioners in a cross-section of educational institutes and just looked at where it comes from. Does it come from all this fantastic legislation that underpins what we do? Is it coming from UNESCO? Is it coming from all of these beautiful, wonderful publications that we see hundreds of thousands each year with wellbeing in it? And actually, that's a small influence. And certainly CPD and PD opportunities in schools is small influence, but more often than not, it's from that individual person's own experiences of childhood, what mattered to them. And also we look at it, you know, and if we think about what does it mean to be included or what does it mean to be active? You know, I've got friends that run marathons. They've just come back from London a couple of weeks ago. And that, to them, an active week is very different, Marie, to what it looks like to me. If I get my 10,000 steps, I'm really pleased. So just narrowing in on what we're talking about and what does it look like to be included? What does it look like to be active in those things? It's such an important discussion, and I would strongly advocate for it to be being had on a school by school level, not nationwide, not even, you know, different areas, just school by school. What do we want for our young people here? What matters to us?
Yeah, definitely. I love that. I really do, because it is about individuals, isn't it? And also, just to say, right at the start, you were talking about that, or the fatigue about the word. And yeah, I totally agree with that, because there is a danger, isn't there, that it's misunderstood, sorry, and that, you know, like you said, that inner eye roll of, oh God, here's another wellbeing initiative, mm-hmm. when they are, you know, I sort of use the phrase sort of a tick box exercise. They're not, you know, they're surface level, sort of this is for your well-being. And it's that thing, isn't it? I think it's bound up in that thing about telling other people what is good for their well-being, rather than perhaps supporting them finding out for themselves what is good.
Absolutely. And I think as well as that, we need to acknowledge that there are so many fantastic things already happen in schools that might not have the banner of this is for your well-being. But, you know, even looking at the schoolhouse system, when we organise pupils into vertical groupings and sort of foster those good social relationships, that's well-being. It doesn't need to be an additional burden, an additional duty, or a refocus. It's acknowledging the fantastic things that are really happening in schools now and why we're doing them and what those outcomes can lead to. And I think that's when we get a real buy-in, and that's when we're seeing it being much more purposeful than that additional, you know, additional thing that teachers can't cope with, because it's a busy, busy day.
Yes, absolutely. So definitely, I think some of what you're saying is kind of recognising what people are already doing and understanding it as well-being, rather than, you know, rather than saying this is things that you need to do on top. Yeah, so could we then, are you happy to share some strategies that teachers can implement? Because, you know, I know we both really wanted this show not to just be talking about kind of the concept of well-being. People who are listening to actually have some practical sort of ideas that they can think about and think about implementing and things. So perhaps starting with your favourite strategy.
Yeah, super. So I think when we're looking at people well-being, we need to focus on sort of three different areas. And this is very much research-based, and you know, I'm not talking about what feels good, I'm talking about what we know works. So the first one really is thinking about the connections and those social relationships. We know that those are some of the most protective features for our young people going through their sort of mid-teen years in particular, where they feel they have connections to teachers, connections to peers. That is a really, really useful tool to looking after their well-being and their mental health as well. So one of the things I frequently do as a classroom teacher, not necessarily as a pastoral lead, but I also do it as a mother with my own small children, and I'm constantly trying to explore that literacy of well-being. Are they able to reflect on how they are? And especially for my younger people, my younger own kids who are primary school age, giving them the sort of the time and the prompt to reflect. So I'll frequently ask them, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how are they? How are you doing today? 1 to 10. 10's marvellous, best day ever. 1 is in crisis, awful. And I'll ask where they are and get the answer. And it might be 5 or it might be 6. And then the next question is really, really important. And I find this really, really useful with my older pupils as well. Again, trying to gauge that, do they need resources? Where are the challenges? The second, excuse me, question is, where are you normally? So are you normally a 5? If so, that's okay. Long term, we can think about how to move you up. But actually, if you're where you usually are, that's okay. And I get them to sort of say, is it within the realms of normality for you today and last week? Or is there a change? Is there something we need to reflect on and think about? Encouraging that just in a really micro level. Sometimes we don't even share it. Sometimes at the start of a lesson, I just ask people, whilst they're settling, just think about where they are on their scales, think about where they were last week and check in with themselves. And again, I'm not seeking it to be a great add-on, but just trying to encourage that moment of pause there and reflection is really important. I think teachers and classroom teachers have a really good vantage point to notice the differences within their pupils. If we look at someone like football player Messi, when he's been analysed on the football pitch, what he's constantly doing is looking around for where the ball is in the next pass. I think in any game, he does this about 400 times. And I think we're quite similar to Messi. I think as teachers, we're constantly scanning the room, checking for next steps, looking at what's going on, what's not going on, and then addressing it. So it's, again, it's clearing the space for that so that we have the systems in place where we've got routines, we've got structure to our lessons so that we're able to respond to those day-to-day needs. And it might be that they come from a learning need as well. So if we're thinking about those three main areas and three main features for wellbeing, those connections are really, really big part of them. And then we've got the learning. So a young person understands who they are in school on those three levels. And it's important that we're able to think about automatic doors. I talk about this quite a lot. So within my classroom and within most classrooms, we have automatic doors for our pupils. And those are the things that are beneficial for everybody. Now, if I go to the supermarket, I walk in through the doors, it's helpful. They all open for me. If I've got my hands full of shopping, it's really useful that they open for me. But for my very good friend who can't use the left side of her body, it's essential. So again, it's thinking about your subject. What can you do that will underpin success for everyone? So for example, in source analysis, it might be that everybody uses a ruler to go through the text so that they're able to access it. This supports our dyslexic learners for whom line tracking is harder, but is useful for everybody. And that underpins well-being because you're not always highlighting the differences or who's using a different strategy. And it's creating that connections that we're not highlighting difference, we're not standing out for negative reasons, and we're supporting them. For the academic progress as well, which is such a big part of wellbeing in school, we know that exams pose one of the biggest challenges to a young person's sort of equilibrium and where they are in their sort of stable emotional being. And again, it's looking at the strategies that we can use to enhance that. Do we need to test? Do we need to have exams? How can we take the pressure off, make the stakes just as reasonable as they always have been, but remove that burden of pressure for our young people? Is it a competency issue? Do we need to think about enhancements? Do we need to think about redoing different things with them for their individual learning? Or is it an emotional response? Do we need to have these conversations? Do we need to flag it on to guidance staff, to pastoral leads? Those are really, really important things because, again, what I'm saying with well-being in classroom teaching, it's not just the burden on one teacher. It should never be left in one individual to oversee that. And it's about using the systems that are already in place. The third thing I would say when we're thinking about well-being in schools is the co-curricular. So that's a huge, important part for a young person. Through the teen years, young people are going through the sort of subjectification of self and they're understanding who they are outside of their family unit, outside of their academic status. And it's really important that they've got the opportunities to see themselves through positive lenses as debaters, as runners, you know, as contributors, as equal reps of all the different things that we can use in the school system to start helping young people build a positive picture of who they are outside of their English test results and to show that they're a whole person. And those are the really protective factors for young people.
That's so fantastic. So I think right at the start, you know, your first thing that you talked about was those connections. And yeah. I totally agree because I think I've had a lot of conversations and sort of previous shows and things as well on those sort of attendance particularly and barriers to attendance. Oh, mm-hmm. And I do think one of the biggest things that you can do is help a pupil, help a young person feel like they belong, you know, that sense of community and connections, like you said. I think, you know, it's so important. Sorry, everyone.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we're looking at connections, it's consistent. You know, we talk about trusting and we talk about bonds and relationships, but, you know, we don't just walk up to people and say, I'd like a relationship with you. I'd like you to trust me. It's that consistency that builds trust. And I know it's so difficult talking about consistency in education when we have such a retention crisis. And that's, you know, I think that's the real, real damage there is the lack of consistency for young people because that builds trust and trust builds relationships. And if we have school systems that enable that, then that's half the battle. And it really does help with things like attendance and school refusers and these very difficult times that young people are facing.
Yeah, and I agree. And I know you've talked about and written about before that sort of student voice and student panels and all of those things. And I guess that kind of links back to what we were talking about recognising what is already in place that can really support wellbeing. I loved what you were saying about the literacy of well-being. And I would say as well, so I'm a parent as well, but I've got two older mm-hmm. boys in through education, and are sort of working now. And I've also got a 5-year-old. And the difference, and this absolutely credit to teachers and to our education system, the difference in that literacy, the emotional literacy, mm-hmm. That is instilled and taught right from year R for my smallest, didn't happen with my other two, not at all. I think there were teachers that cared, and there was PSHE and so on. But the difference in my 5-year-old, like I said, coming home and saying he knows about the zones of regulation, for example, and how to move from a blue to mm-hmm. a green. What to do if he's feeling worried, and he was chatting to me about something that was on his mind the other night, and I said, I'm so glad that you can talk to me. And he said, well, you have to talk to someone, don't you? It could be your mum, it could be your teacher, but you've got to talk. And I thought, that is just the change that we've had. I can see it just mm-hmm. in having children from different, in different age groups.
From the mouths of babes, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's a different era of education. I know myself, I think I consider ever having gone to teacher and said I felt anxiety or I felt stress. Mm-hmm. I just don't even think they'd have a response for me. Like, they'd just send me on my way. It's just, exactly. And that's a really positive thing that we do need to celebrate. And so often I think this is really something that's seen as a negative and we've got a crisis and this and schools aren't doing enough. But no, I think actually if we have a wee 10-year reflection, schools have done a massive amount, and it's really promising to see the change.
Oh, huge. And I think, it's something that I think I feel like I know a fair bit about. But he said one to me the other day that I hadn't heard of. So he'd obviously been taught it at school. He said, I'm a bit worried about this, so I'm going to do my spirals. And then he was just sort of doing a little spiral on the back of his hand with his fingers. So I don't know that one. I thought that's brilliant. He was just sort of regulating. There is a huge difference, and I think, like I said, absolute credit to all those teachers out there that are really teaching this literacy and this, I think, recognition, isn't it? It's about recognising mm-hmm. how we're learning, and then very quickly, if it's so intrinsically there, just pulling out those strategies to regulate. Everyone's done a really great job on that. And the last thing that you were saying, that automatic doors, I just love that. Again, it's something I've had lots of conversations about, sort of inclusivity. And the biggest thing the biggest message that I believe is that inclusivity is beneficial for everyone. It's not making, like you said, those automatic doors help everyone.
Yes, absolutely. We don't have separate ones, do we? And so if you're able-bodied, you should go here and you should go there. It's just how part and parcel of society. And I think that, again, we're making huge progress embedding that. And even the way we set up lessons, and we know in schools, or certainly hope we don't use underline anymore for our dyslexic learners when we're publishing work or we're posting text and things like this. And just really small basic things that actually do add up, like small links in a chain, to make a big difference without being a burden for anyone.
Yeah, and not highlighting it for that pupil that's mm-hmm. having those the benefits. But I think just those, it's about the routines, isn't it? I think once you get into a routine of providing all those things, it becomes quite natural, and people are able to just access what they need. This is already so fascinating and so interesting, but we're just going to go to the news now, and then I think when we return it would be really good to start talking about, sort of based on your research and your experience, your years of experience, about the role that teachers can play in supporting and promoting this well-being.
Absolutely, yeah.
Brilliant, thank you.
Speak soon.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher
who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult
was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions. At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
BBC News reports that MI5 has briefed vice-chancellors from 24 universities across the UK on the threat from foreign states which could undermine national security. The vice-chancellors were warned that cutting-edge research could be targeted by states seeking to boost their own militaries and economies. The Deputy Prime Minister has also announced a consultation on measures to protect UK universities. There has been no direct reference to any one state, but the government has previously warned that China could be gaining influence in British academic research. The institutions involved in the briefing included Oxford, Cambridge, and Imperial College London. The head of the Russell Group said its members take their national security responsibilities incredibly seriously. The chief executive of Universities UK said the body has worked with government for several years. The latest particular threat could be to academic research that has a potential dual use in civilian and military life. The Guardian features the topic of Ofsted one-word judgments as it appears in the news once again. Reaction to the news features prominently in the article, with primary focus given to the views of Professor Julia Waters, sister of Ruth Perry. Ms. Perry's death following an Ofsted inspection prompted a review of a range of aspects of the inspection process, with one-word judgments a main focus of interest. In a statement published on the 25th of April, the government has ruled that the judgments are here to stay. Professor Waters described the government's response to an inquiry by the Commons Education Committee as woefully inadequate. Teaching unions had backed calls for the scrapping of the single word judgments and of more radical reform to the inspectorate in England. The announcement came as something of a shock, as days earlier the Sunday Times had published a story suggesting the single word judgment would likely be scrapped. Government have stated that the headline grades provide a succinct and accessible summary for parents, and that they enable government to look at inspection outcomes across England. The statement went on to say they would continue to listen as part of the Big Listen public consultation, although many have criticised the wording of some of the questions, which appear to prevent clear, critical feedback. It seems that funding for education isn't just a hot topic for the UK. The BBC Latin American news site reports on protests in Buenos Aires as thousands of people took to the streets to demand increased funding for public universities. Argentina's president came to office in 2023 and vowed to take a chainsaw to public spending and justified the cuts by calling the state-run universities centres of socialist indoctrination. Ricardo Gelpi, rector of University of Buenos Aires, says the institution may have to close within 3 months without more funding. Pictures from the demonstration show tens of thousands of protesters dancing, playing instruments and holding banners. The BBC also report on a World Health Organization report which shows that a third of 11-year-olds and more than half of 13-year-olds in England have drunk alcohol. Girls were found to be more likely than boys to be drinking and getting drunk aged 15 in England, Wales and Scotland. The World Health Organization called on countries to introduce more measures to protect children. The report looked at data from 4,500 school-aged children from each country in Europe, Central Asia and Canada between 2021 and 22. The focus was on use of cigarettes, vaping, alcohol and cannabis among adolescents. The UK has always had relatively high alcohol use amongst young people, but it has been declining. On cannabis use, the report found more boys in Scotland had used the drug compared to all other countries. No data was provided for England. Smoking is much less common, but the report confirmed that vaping rates have overtaken it in most countries and are above average in the UK. Full details of the report can be found on the BBC website. Finally, Cambridge University's Fitzwilliam College has apologised to students after housekeeping staff allegedly embarrassed one individual by posting images of their messy room. Pictures of the communal areas and a bedroom were emailed around the college as an illustration of what housekeeping staff don't want to see. But the college has since apologised, saying the inclusion of the image of a bedroom was unacceptable and an invasion of privacy. Students had also complained that they were being woken up and asked to tidy communal areas too early, although the college says it has stopped this practice in response to feedback. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
So welcome back, Kirsten. I always love to listen to the news when I do the show, because it's just such a really handy way to keep abreast of everything that's going on in education. And I was just thinking then about those statistics about alcohol and drinking, and how that, you know, it's probably a topic for another show. But
no, it's really interesting, actually. You know, when we think about, and we teach this in schools, don't we? But actually, if you dig into the statistics, in the UK, four nations wide, around 70% of our 15-year-olds describe themselves as non-drinkers. And yeah. I think it's really important to also focus on that and to give the strategies to our non-drinkers. How do you navigate a party and your peer pressure? And you know, even how do you rehearse a response to "no, I'm not drinking" that supports your own view on it? And I think sometimes we don't talk about that enough in schools, and we demonise it. We only focus on the sort of the minority statistics of binge drinkers, yeah, who get it wrong. And it's important to talk about that too. But also, you know, I do think we have to acknowledge that there are three ways to be a drinker. You know, there's the non-drinker, there's the sensible drinker, and then there's the problem drinker. And often we just focus on that last one.
That's so true. I mean, I actually saw something about that. It was about, just in general, I think it was about adults. I saw a post on X about it, was saying if someone says, "No, I'm not drinking," don't ask why. Just go, because people tend to, don't they?
Well, absolutely. It's a conversation starter, isn't it? It's so countercultural, I think, as well. But yeah, no, it's a complete sentence. "No, I'm not drinking, thank you." That's all it needs sometimes.
Really, but I think it's that, you know, the default is why. So as we said before the news, it just would be really interesting to hear, sort of through your research and your experience, a little bit about the sort of the role that teachers play in supporting and promoting the sort of mental and emotional health of students.
Yeah, thank you. And it's an area of real growth when we look at the research as well coming through. As we said earlier, you know, time and tide has changed on this, and it's something that's much more sort of in line with our educational aims, you know, in terms of academic success as well. And that's given rise to a huge body of research. But I think as well, I always like to come back and reflect on ourselves as teachers and what we really are. And I think, we're the gatekeepers to education, and a good education changes lives, it improves lives, it safeguards emotional, mental, financial health and well-being for life. And I think we need to think about that as a moment and just see how powerful as teachers we are for that young person's entire understanding of who they are as a learner. You know, Mary, I sat parents evening before many times, and as a history teacher, you get two types of parents. You get the parents who love a bit of history and want to talk about World War II or one or whatever their chosen period of interest is. And you get other parents who have sat there in front of me and said how much they hated school. And you can see that they feel uncomfortable and that, "Oh, I hated school. And oh, it was hard for me." And they're in that emotional space. And I see that. And, you know, I have friends in my life who've gone on to be very successful. But if you ask them about themselves as a learner, they'll tell you about themselves basically as a 14-year-old who was not fully engaged. And that's who they believe they still are. So I think primarily we need to respect that. And we need to see that whilst we might not catch all pupils in our big academic net, we might not get them all to colleges and universities, but actually they might come back to us one day if we give them a good enough experience and we let them know that they belong here too, and that education is not just for some. And that's a privilege, and that's a huge responsibility, and something I think about a lot.
Yeah.
The other thing I think as well is if we come back to that belonging and that sense of identity that comes from schools, you know, teachers are our greatest resources within education, and we do so many wonderful things, and we have that great overview, because often we'll see pupils more than, you know, their pastoral lead or year head will. So we're really, really well placed to spot the differences, to spot a change in young people, and to come back to that sort of seesaw and think about, are those challenges that that young person normally copes well with, are they overwhelming them? What can we do to respond? How can we change that? And that being known is more important as well for longer term health. In 2021, there was some really good research. It was a lengthy study that had been done. It was about 7 years in the making, and hundreds of school age pupils had been sampled. And what they found is that where there was school-based inclusion in activities outside of the classroom, that was a direct predictor for mental health problems later in their 20s. And it really highlights how significant those clubs, those activities, those extras, and those things that we can do as part and parcel of school experiences are. Now, I'm not about to say it's the role of teachers to put on lots and lots of clubs and activities. It's about using the systems that are already in place. I mentioned earlier the house system, and thinking about how that creates a culture of identity and gives pupils the chance to work with other older year groups, younger year groups, to mentor and to build those social connections. The other thing I think we need to reflect on with the research as well, and this is never particularly popular when I touch on this, is really being aware that there are no silver bullets, that magic wellbeing wand does not exist. And what we're finding out more and more about different strategies, for example, looking at mindfulness, is that they've been really over-egged the effectiveness. And I think it's really natural that we all like to find a solution. We like to find something actionable that we can use. But if we look at the Myriad project, for example, what we're seeing there is certainly the enthusiasm was ahead of the evidence when we started to think about mindfulness strategies as a way of sort of responding to anxiety and stress and difficulties a young person has. So as teachers, I think we do need to be really wary of the things that do work, and we need to be really quite sceptical of the additional extras and the new ideas that actually might take up a lot of time and resources, but we just don't have proof in the, you know, the proof's not there yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, for one thing as well, that then has, you know, an impact on teacher well-being, isn't it? You're then spending a lot of time and effort in these new initiatives, which then arguably, you know, aren't going to have the impact. And yeah, like you said, I think, you know, we've returned to it a couple of times. It is that message, isn't it? There isn't a magic wand that you can do. Our society, isn't there? You know, is constantly changing. There isn't ever going to be one solution, is there? Like, I think, you know, what you're saying is having a range.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we think about someone like Dave Brailsford, I'm not sure if you're aware of him, but he was brought in as the British cycling manager in 2003. Now, up until then, the British cycling team, sort of the professional team, they'd not performed particularly well. And there was, you know, there's even a bike company in Europe that refused to let them use their products because they felt it was bad advertising to have this team that just were failing to be successful in the traditional sense in sport. And Dave Brailsford came in, and what he looked at was he looked at all the different component parts of being a good cyclist, and he broke them down and initially embedded some really minor changes. Like, he adjusted the bike seats and he changed the massage gel. But his argument and his underlining principle was if he could improve every small action by just 1%, the sort of the aggregation of those small micro changes added up to a very big sustainable change. So at one point he brought medics in to teach the cyclists how to wash their hands properly so they wouldn't get sick. He changed their pillows, you know, he changed tiny little things that don't seem significant. And I think for us in education, it's a much more healthy, balanced way to look at well-being. You know, what's the 1% change I can make in my classroom now, and then my colleague can, and so on. And it's sustainable, and it's not this newfangled way of doing things that we're going to completely change everything, and then again in 10 years we're going to rehaul it all. But stick to what we're good at, stick to what we know, and stick to it, and you know, and assess the changes, and give it time as well. I think is more healthy for everybody, actually, Mary.
Oh, definitely. Like, I love that. This is the 1% change. What can I do now that's going to make things 1% better? And like you said, mm-hmm. it's almost, you know, that ripple effect, isn't it? Or like, you know, that culminative.
And actually, you know, if we think about it, sorry, just to finish the story there, I always forget to finish it, is, you know, we look at the success that they did have, you know, Tour de France's Olympic medals, if we look at what happened to the British team, it did, arguably that and a number of other things did work for them as well, like Chris Hoy, for example, you know?
Yeah, but that's... It's like I guess it's a mindset thing, isn't it? You know, like you said, you're not taking on, I'm gonna change everything and bring in all these initiatives and I'm gonna transform the well-being of everyone. Mm-hmm. It's constant, you know, the consistency that you spoke about right at the beginning as well, isn't it? That's at the root of those connections and trust and safety, that consistency in making small changes gonna add up. So should we just talk a little bit about the challenges, I think, that teachers face, because, you know, we've started to talk about it a little bit, you know, that sort of factor, the impact on them and mental health and well-being, the newfangled approaches and researches that come out and everyone goes, oh, this is going to completely fix it, and then it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we talk a bit about that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that we're marred by constant political changes and, you know, everybody wants a different thing from education. We've got inspection pressures, pay battles. You know, we're required in all these different issues coming at us from different directions. Parents want something different. Pupils want something different. There's never really a sort of agreed, unlike medics, you know, everybody wants health, good health. That's always the outcome for a doctor. But for us, I think that we're constantly trying to spin plates and meet the needs of different people. And there's so many different ways and means to do it. It's exhausting and it's really difficult. And I think that, you know, there's arguments, certainly if you look at what's happened within the SEND provision recently and the crisis that we're in there, there's this, we need more capacity, but actually what we don't need to do is build extensions. We need to change what we're doing. I'm not sure if you've read Mary Myatt, Back on Track. She's a brilliant book, and it's a really good critical examination of the outdated school processes and actually how much of what we do is aligning to our core mission of education. What is it we want to achieve, and what are the activities we're doing that have nothing to do with that, that we can perhaps remove from the burden of our staff and really focus on what it is we're trying to do. I think we need to think very, very carefully about a number of different things. You know, homework, if my argument, and, you know, I'm very much influenced and led by the research here, if it can't be done in 8 hours, should it be getting done at home? And I mean that for teachers and for staff. I think that's something that needs to be revisited. I think too often in this space I operate in within wellbeing and education, there's an assumption that if you're into well-being, you know, you're not looking at the academic outcomes, and it's this division as well within educational thinkers as well, and I feel that quite often. But actually, I argue all the time, a good education changes lives, and if we can find ways to make that easier for young people, that safeguards well-being forever. So thinking about those routines, you know, and I talk a lot about this in my writing as well, can you go into your school and can you verbalize the rules, the behavior policy? Do you as a teacher, probably there for many years, is it tangible? Because if it isn't, then actually that's a conversation that needs to be had with senior leaders, because so much of that frees up the capacity of teachers to deal with those other things, to have those discussions about emotional literacy. And if you don't have that in order, then you are fighting a losing battle and you are firefighting day in, day out, and it's truly, truly draining for everybody. So I'm a big believer in this sort of two schools of thought not being divided and really thinking about it from a collective perspective about those, you know, that alignment of what is the core mission of your education and how do we get there? I think as well when we're oh sorry big. What were you going to say, Marie?
Well, I was just going to say, I really agree. I've had similar conversations about what is the goal of education, what is our goal, and then working back from that, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and how do we achieve that? So it is the goal. I mean, really, mm-hmm. the goal is still a love of learning, you know, and that excitement of learning and things like that, you know, and work backwards. And I just love what you're saying. If if there's something that isn't working towards that goal, then does it need to be there? Also, I completely agree that sometimes there is that divisiveness, and it's if you're prioritizing well-being, you're not prioritizing academic. And equally, I totally agree that that's not the case. They are not, you know, they're not mutually exclusive. And you know, academic progression and that mm-hmm. identity, all of those things, like we were saying, that you know, in your teenage years you are building your identity away from your family, you know, they aren't exclusive, are they, at all? And actually they build on each other.
Oh, absolutely. And I think as well, we think about our staff, we think about what it is that drives us as humans and as species. It's, you know, first of all, our basic needs. And schools are generally, you know, we have those basic needs, you know, we're warm enough generally, we have access to water, all those things. We need to be paid well enough that money's off the table. And I think that's where I think there needs to be an awareness of just how wearing the salary battles really are on the profession. And I don't mean paid enough to take it off the table as in that we're all millionaires and wealthy, but so that we feel valued, so that we can afford a decent life, so that we can move on from that. And then ultimately what keeps us in education is the interest, is the fact that it's such a fantastic career where you're working with different people and you've got ideas, and young people are just so enjoyable to spend time with. And yeah. And I think that, again, that's where, you know, do you have the opportunities within schools to, you know, to have conversations like this? You know, I've managed to move a meeting so that I can have this conversation today because I've got a really, really supportive team who value what I do. And that's, you know, when I speak to other people who do similar work to me, that's not the norm. And it should be, because, you know, when you look at Google, they've got the 80-20 rule where 20% of a worker's time is for them to direct. And that's where we got Google Mail from, you know, because people were given the creative space to actually pursue things that enhance who they are as individuals. And that only can benefit your workplace. You know, we've got commitment there and we've got freedom to explore different parts of our interests. That's got such a far reaching impact than being process led and told that you have to do X, Y, and Z. One of the best head teachers I worked for a number of years ago, and I always remember as a really young teacher, I think we were all there late because, you know, I didn't have a family and I was young and I was enthusiastic. And he said to me, if you're here after 5, that's not good to me. I want a person in front of my class. I want a human who has more than just an ability to deliver a curriculum. Go home, go and get a hobby. And I think actually, you know, staying late, not a badge of honour. That's, you know, perhaps he was concerned about my efficiency, which maybe that was a factor too. But you know, I think we need to not lose sight of the fact that we are humans trying to help smaller humans understand their cultural inheritance, their place in the world, and initiation into the world as well.
Absolutely. We're just going to very briefly hear from our sponsors. And then when we come back, should we spend just the last part of the show just on your top three strategies that someone can listen to today and then go away and think about that 1% change?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a lovely, lovely way to finish. Thank you, Marie.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
So just to go back briefly to what you were saying before the ads, Kirsten, I think I just sat your head teacher, that head teacher that you had sounds fantastic, but also completely agree, isn't it? Because there is a thing about staying late, being one out, and that's sort of a badge of honour, and therefore you must be working the hardest and you know, being the most committed to the role. But equally, I have always thought, I mean, one, if it doesn't fit within your working hours, you know, then potentially there is something, isn't there, about how, whether it's workload or how you're managing your time or effectiveness. But also, I just loved that what you were saying, you know, have a hobby.
Yeah, I think I was offended at the time that you said it, but upon reflection and looking back now and seeing it differently, you know, as I've gone through a career, he was so right. You know, you need to be multidimensional. We're not just, you know, we're not just there to deliver a curriculum and stand there and direct learning. That's not our role. Our role is so much bigger than that. And it is also to role model well-being and connectedness and all those things that we've been talking about through the programme, Mary.
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was going to say. I was going to say role modelling, because also I think when you've got things in your life that you're, you know, passionate about or things that you enjoy doing and things like that, it shows. I think it shows your enthusiasm and, you know, and if you're looking after yourself. Sorry, I'm going to cough again.
Looking after yourself, Mary.
Potentially, I should probably look at that. We'll move on from that. So let's go with then, just for the last bit of the show, just some strategies that somebody could just go away and think about implementing.
So definitely, the way I'm coming at this one is I'm thinking, if I had three things I could, you know, say to my classroom or say to my young people, what would they be? So the first one as a classroom teacher is to have the conversation about sleep. And I have this regularly with my pupils, not just when one looks tired, and I would avoid having a direct conversation with one individual, because often young people can read it as a badge of honour that they might have only had a few hours sleep. But when I'm talking about learning, when I'm talking about preparation for exams, when I'm thinking about the stress that comes with that period for young people, and we know it's one of the biggest threats to wellbeing, I'm telling them to look after themselves and how important adequate sleep is for learning and for retention of information. So that would be my first one, is don't shy away from looking at the whole picture of a learner. And if you're preparing young people for study leave, mention that. Talk to them about healthy routines if you can. What does a study revision plan look like that also embeds rest? Because, you know, the human brain requires a huge amount of rest. It requires a lot of processing time, and sleep is a really active process, and it's so often overlooked for young people who, for hormonal reasons and changes in the brain, will start to have differences in their sleep patterns. But I cannot stress enough, for well-being, academic success, everything, sleep, definitely a conversation to be had there. And I would encourage all teachers to think about how they can broach that in their classrooms. The second is to really think about knowing that pupil. And I think that we almost assume that the process of getting to know our pupils is a bit like osmosis. But, you know, I have colleagues that will see pretty much every pupil within the school that we teach in. And for them, that's hundreds and hundreds of pupils every single week. And actually, the cognitive load of getting to know the names of everybody is really, really challenging. So one, acknowledging that and being honest about that, that is the first process in the game of getting to know your peoples and that connection and that belongingness. So find systems that work for you. Now, I think in preparation for our talk today, Marie, I said to you that I'm not very fast at thinking. So I like a heads up about what we're going to talk about, because whilst I enjoy writing, it does sometimes just take me a bit longer to respond verbally. So I appreciate that you did give me a heads up for the questions. But knowing that about myself, you know, use the seating plans, use the strategies, use that retrieval practice, get pupils to help quiz you on their names, and don't feel that it will just happen through osmosis, because for young people, the right to be known, the power of being known, you know, as part of my research on my writing projects, I spoke to pupils and they know when a teacher doesn't know their name. They know in November when that teacher's had them since September, and it doesn't feel good. So it might sound really, really basic and it might sound really simple, but think about a strategy and think about how you can make that work for you, particularly if you are a subject that sees high volumes of pupils for maybe short periods of time, because it is a cognitive challenge for everybody.
Yeah.
And lastly, if I'm thinking about the only other thing I could do to look after my young people, is I would just have those conversations about what else is on offer. So if I'm teaching a subject, and I'm qualified in a couple of different subjects. So I've had one pupil that always sticks in my mind who was genuinely concerned about her when I taught her for history. She was not very engaged. She didn't like it. I tried a number of different strategies and I was really concerned about her progress. And then I had the fortune of teaching her for economics, and she was a completely different pupil and she was really engaged. And actually that taught me a lesson about looking at the bigger picture of who that young person is. And outside of your classroom, they might be a different person. So where possible, give them the opportunity to show you that, give them the opportunity to show themselves that, and don't just view them through that one singular lens in that one subject area. And acknowledge that with your class as well. And you know, who they are in history is like the pinky nail in their body of who they are as a person. And it's important at the time, but it's not the summation of who they are as a person. So I think those would be my three tips. If I've been concise and perhaps been a bit verbose, but I hope that was meaningful.
I love those. Yeah, you have. Very impressively so. And I just love those strategies. Sleep, like you said, it is so integral. And yet, I mean, I think sleep is an issue for a lot of young people, for many reasons. But also I love what you said about, you know, not necessarily just targeting one person who looks like they're tired, but just embedding it as, you know, as something to talk about and something to kind of really educate and embed those healthy sleep habits and why, you know, it's not a telling off, is it? It's not you should go to that area. It's about why and, you know, and what that means for your brain and your health and your education. I really liked the second one as well. You're right. I think every single young person that I know or have taught over the years have gone, they know if somebody doesn't really know who they are.
Oh, they do, don't they? Yeah.
Somebody's not being honest, you're kind of covering up if you're pretending you haven't forgotten their name, you know, and like you said, that doesn't feel great for anyone, let alone a young with instill this sense of belonging and trust and safety. But I actually really loved your answer to that, is be honest, because we are humans. And I loved as well what you said about knowing things yourself, you know, what are your limitations? And just saying, I'm likely to find that a bit difficult. So this is what we're going to do. So, and I just love that approach, you know, being upfront and honest to the pupils and say, look, there's 200 of you. I want to know you. I want to know your names, but it's, you know, it's going to be a little bit tricky. So this is what we're going to do. So I can. And I just really loved that approach. And then, you know, I just think that what you've described are three things that are just really good to go and do that 1%. And remember that, what was the analogy? You know, that student in history, that's just the pinky nail of their existence.
Yeah, of who they are. And it might be, and you know, that was such a good learning curve for me to see that same pupil in a different subject thrive. Because I would have, you know, if you'd asked me who they were as a learner, I'd have had a very different lens to look through that with. But actually, what a great lesson for me to have learned. And it's something that I do reflect on with others as well. And, you know, I think if I'd asked my own maths teacher at school, he'd have a very different view of who I was as a learner to my English teacher, you know, and I would have known that, but, you know, it's important to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. So, thank you so much. I knew that today was going to race by, and I can't believe that an hour. But, you know, I just think that you're absolutely inspirational. And I just love how you've explained everything as well, with all that kind of research behind it. That's the thing. It's not wishy-washy. It's not eye roll or another well-being thing. It's the actual research. It's the strategies that you know, listeners, you can go away and just implement. I know why we're doing it.
Absolutely. And if anybody wants to reach out and ask for any of the research or any of the things I've spoken about today, then please do catch me on Twitter. I'd be more than happy to continue the discussion there with anybody.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you to your colleagues who've pushed back that meeting as well. I really appreciate it. But I hope you have a really lovely rest of the day, and it's been so nice.
Thank you, Marie. You too. Take care and rest up.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.